Hello, hello, and welcome back to Art House Garage, the snob-free film podcast where we make art house, indie, classic, and foreign cinema accessible to the masses. That's our mission, to help people find a way into challenging films, and that's why today's film is the perfect subject to dive into. We're looking at the new film from writer-director Charlie Kaufman called I'm Thinking of Ending Things, which was released on Netflix last Friday. This is a bonus episode outside of our regular podcast. We are actually in the middle of season 5 of the podcast, looking at contemporary Asian filmmakers, but we're stepping away from that today to look at this film. I was excited to watch this because Charlie Kaufman is one of my favorite filmmakers. This movie is strange and surreal and philosophical and funny and dark and just plain mysterious. When I watched it, I knew I just had to get on the podcast to talk about it. And I have a special guest with me, my friend and filmmaker, Andrew Camarillo. Andrew was my guest on the podcast for all of season 4, which was the Art House Starter Pack. And he was the guest way back on episode 9, about 2 years ago, when we discussed Charlie Kaufman's other film, Synecdoche, New York. That episode of the podcast is actually the most popular one ever, so I knew for all those reasons I had to have Andrew back for this discussion. So Andrew, how are you? So good to have you. How have you been?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to talk about this film. It was really exciting to watch, and I'm happy you're having me on. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's quite an experience of a movie, and so let's get into it. So because I have so many notes I want to talk through, we're going to skip over the what have you been watching section of the podcast and get right into it. So here we go. Let's talk about I'm Thinking of Ending Things.
Jake, my boyfriend.
It's snowing.
Winter is coming in.
We have a real connection, a rare and intense attachment. I've never experienced anything like it. I'm thinking of ending things.
Huh?
What?
Did you say something?
I don't think so.
Weird.
I'm visiting Jake's parents for the first time. He hasn't been my boyfriend for very long.
They really are looking forward to meeting you.
I think of ending things.
Hello? We're here.
Oh, hi.
Oh, it's all wet.
Here they come.
Oh, Jake has told us so much about you.
He's told me so much about both of you, too.
And you came anyway? Jake tells me you're studying quantum psychics.
Physics.
Really?
But there's just something profoundly wrong here.
Are you okay?
Yeah. I think of endings.
I am so glad.
All right, let's talk about I'm Thinking of Ending Things. As I said, this is from writer-director Charlie Kaufman, who is a filmmaker that I've been able to see almost all of his work, all of his directed films at this point. His previous two films that he's directed are Synecdoche, New York, which I mentioned at the top of the show, and then a film called Anomalisa, which is an interesting kind of a smaller in some ways. It's a stop motion animation. It's also an odd film, but I really like it. But he's also written several pretty high profile things and won awards for his writing. One of my favorite movies ever is Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, which he wrote the script for. The film Adaptation, Being John Malkovich, some pretty high profile things. So he's I think one of the best probably writers in my opinion in Hollywood right now. And so when I found out that he was gonna put a new movie out this year, I was very excited about that. So this movie, I'm Thinking of Ending Things, is it's kind of in line with his other work, I think. I think if I hadn't seen anything else by him, I would have a harder time connecting with it, probably. It's full of just lots of ideas. It reminds me of like a long form poem or something, like a T.S. Eliot poem or something. It's just got so many different ideas, kind of crammed into it. And some of those are best expressed in a dialogue between two characters. Some of them are, best expressed with cinematic images, and it seems like he is kind of getting at the same thing that a poem like that might. That's the way I'm thinking about it anyway, but through a film. The tone of it is odd. It's surreal. I think even maybe more so than Synecdoche, New York. In that one, you start out with a pretty grounded story, kind of like with this one, but I think this one goes weird more quickly than that film. Would you agree with that, Andrew?
Yes, I think so. I think the tone shifts rather quickly, and we start to experience things that feel, very surreal or like magic realism, mm-hmm. very quickly compared to Synecdoche, New York.
Yeah, I think that's true. Right towards the beginning, we hear some voiceover or we see a character in a window looking out, and I had a sense that, and again, this is just because I've seen other things that he's made, like I think that was a character, another character just older, and like there's some strange time things going on. And that gets into one of the themes I want to talk about. One of the best ways, I think, to understand what Charlie Kaufman's trying to do. Before I get into that, let me say, I think probably there's 1,000 reactions you can have to this movie, and they're all valid. This is the best way I understood it, and if you're struggling to understand it, this might help you. So I'll say that I'm by no means correct about things. There's actually an article out that someone sent me on IndieWire that is Charlie Kaufman explaining the movie, and I started to read it, and I was like, I think I want to wait a while and kind of have my own thoughts with it before I read that. But that exists too, and I'll link to it if that that may also help you out. But the way time works here is unusual, I'll say, which is similar in Synecdoche, New York. I think maybe it happens a little less, that we have kind of jumps through time. And it's not exactly time travel. It's just that all time seems to be happening at once, or things are mixing up. The best way I could think about it is there's the Kurt Vonnegut novel, Slaughterhouse-Five, in which a character becomes unstuck in time. And so basically he's not adhering to the linear timeline, and he's able to jump around. And that's sort of what's happening here. We have characters jumping into an older version of themselves. Another character is a younger version of themselves in the same scene, and it's just jumping around without a normal linear timeline like we would expect, and that's a very confounding experience, I think, to jump into. It actually perfectly ties into some of the most recent podcast episodes for other movies that I've been doing here. And I know you've listened to some of that, Andrew, with the Thai films from Apichit Pong Wirasathakul. There's a lot there about reincarnation with Uncle Boon Mi, who can recall his past lives, is one of those films. And there is also just a sense of not adhering to linear time. But they get into that really more explicitly here. Actually, so the full circle connection is that kind of came to me while I was watching it. Is so with Uncle Boon Mi, we talked about that kind of part of time with it, and then we looked at Roger Ebert's review for that film, in which he quotes Wordsworth, the poet William Wordsworth, and Wordsworth says something in one of his poems, which can't remember the title, but I'll mention it in a minute because it ties into this movie. Wordsworth says, basically saying that when we're babies, we can remember heaven. And so that idea is that, again, that time is not linear, that we just experience it that way. And in the poem, which I was able to read some of, he basically talks about babies having this celestial glow, and kind of as we age, we don't see the light, quote unquote, as we once did, talking about whether that's like the light of heaven or something like that. So all that to say, that poem is specifically mentioned by the character Jake. So that was just, if you've been listening through the podcast, there's a nice little connection there to some of the previous films we've been doing. But kind of more on that aspect of time. Well, let me first stop and, Andrew, do you have thoughts about like the way the timeline is working here? It is such a confusing thing. How did you make sense of that?
Well, having previously watched some of Kaufman's other films that he's written and directed, I think this is a tool that he uses at times, kind of layering time. It seems to be like compounding time together and having different experiences from the characters change over time. Sometimes they seem to be, when they're younger, it's being displayed, or when they're older, but also sometimes they seem to be embodying or inhabiting the experiences of others and then manifesting them to other characters. So it's very interesting how time works with identity. I think they come hand in hand with Kaufman, and the changes in one's identity, perhaps, or what identity is over time to the individual or to the character, and how each character is also made up of time, but also made up of maybe potentially the identities of others or what's around them in society. At first I felt a bit confused in the beginning of the film, with sort of the relationship of these characters, and their identity to each other, and the relationship. But I think over time you get a sense that this is just how the film's going to be. Identities and time are going to be kind of flowing back and forth, and they're kind of, like you said, I guess, unstuck in time, sort of free. Which is really interesting, but a bit disorienting at first.
Yeah, absolutely. And she has a line too about, it's even in the trailer, about we think of ourselves as like at a point in time and moving through it. But she says, I think it's the other way around. We sit still and time flows through us. And so with that and the Thai films that I mentioned, I did a little research about just time, the concept of time. And I think I would call this movie pretty philosophical. They talk at one point about color and how it's similar to time, in that color exists only in our own heads. And that's the same thing for time. It's just an experience that we have. Our brain creates color for us to make meaning out of what we're seeing. And kind of maybe time is the same way, that we, just because we experience it a certain way doesn't mean that's how it actually operates, I guess. And so it struck me that, that just seems like maybe Kaufman loves to play around with that idea. Let's see. So they say there is no color, it exists only in the brain. The only way we can really experience time, the way we think of time, is because we can notice changes. So, and I think perception is another big part of this, perception and experience, that the ways we experience the world is just completely defines how we understand it. And that there's a lot of just kind of almost jokes about that, but just like conversations around that idea. And so I think the way Kaufman uses that, it helped me to think about, like, in the movies we can kind of break the rules of reality for creative effect or for fun. I thought about even something like a big silly action movie, like a Fast and the Furious or something like that. They completely break the laws of physics because it's a lot of fun. They have fun doing that. In this movie, maybe he's kind of doing a somewhat similar thing by just throwing the laws of time out the window. And what points can he make by doing that? So that kind of helped me to frame that. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, the creative act, in the creative act, it seems for Kaufman, he enjoys the bending of rules of reality, or what we know as reality, the day-to-day, where we are seeming to be locked into like a linear experience, something with cause and effect. For Kaufman and his films, I think the flouting of these rules and kind of just... I think making the walls and structures of reality more permeable and kind of blending things together is something he really enjoys. And I think it allows him to discuss topics and ideas and also experiences and feelings in a way that would be possibly more difficult for him if he abided by, you know, realism, whatever that, what we think of that in film, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. And so I think with the time aspect of this, there's the one thing that was kind of mysterious to me, and you may have an idea about it, was there's several kind of repetitive motions, like the one that first comes to mind is the dog shaking up the water. It's just like it's stuck there, and then there's also some repetitive waving, some repetitive laughing from his parents, And I actually, maybe this is just pointing to the fact that time isn't working quite the way we would expect. There's also repetition visually, like with, there's like a lot of wallpaper and like her dress print, has this repetitive floral pattern. So I think maybe that's just hinting at, you know, time isn't linear. Maybe it's repetitive and circular or something, which again, that's a sort of philosophical idea I don't fully understand, but I think it's kind of maybe pointing in that direction.
Yeah, it seems like reoccurrence and repetition are important for Kaufman, and exploring that in the day-to-day is important, and then also as an act of, I guess, it's difficult for me to think of where Kaufman's coming from with it, but for me it seems to signify, and how I experience it, the reoccurrence of specific events that kind of stick out to oneself, personally, subjectively. Like, I think there are events in my life where I can replay an event happening over and over, or something that maybe was a daily routine for me, and then how that act brings a sense of atmosphere, feeling, tone, or space, and it kind of just seems to be a sign or a symbol, not of really anything directly related to it, but just almost of, this is a space of time. This is an experience that reminds me of a particular way of being that I was in a time. And I see that throughout Kaufman's films, these reoccurring things, a repetitive people as well, like doubles, duplicates. Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is really interesting. And it feels to me, maybe something personal to Kaufman. Some of these, there's also several swings in many of his films. And also, like you discussed, floral, like wallpaper, this happens over and over again in his films. And, maybe it's a touchstone to something subjective for him of his life, but I don't know, but if I put something in a film like that, I think I would relate to it in that way.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, I like that. And that reminds me too of another kind of thought I had with this as I was just thinking through kind of the mind-boggling way that time is used here. And just thinking about, as I was just researching, like, is time linear, or that just the way we experience it? It helped me to think about, like, we give special preference to the present moment, because that's what's most real to us. Like, we experience life in a series of moments. But if we think back, there's talk about nostalgia and memories in this movie. We think back to things that happened in the past, or we can think ahead to things that might happen in the future. And those moments in the future and moments in the past are just as real. They just don't feel quite as real to us. So that was another just kind of way to frame that helped me out a little bit.
Right. Yes. No, I think that's important for thinking of Kaufman's work, how time, our abilities to like move back in time and then move forward in time. And I think there's a line in the film that kind of pertains to that humans are unable to live in the present, so they've invented hope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So kind of on that subject of time and the way humans experience it, there's a quote where it's a voiceover. A lot of there's a lot of voiceover in the film from Lucy's, we think her name. It's kind of unclear if that is in fact her name at one point. And actually, I watched part of this with subtitles, and it always just says young woman is speaking. It doesn't have a character name for her, because I call her Lucy, and at one point he calls her Amy, and she's like, wait, what is my name? Which is an odd thing. But anyway, her voiceover says, everything has to die. That's the truth. One likes to think that there's always hope, that you can live above death. And it's a uniquely human fantasy that things will get better, born perhaps of the uniquely human understanding that things will not. And then she says, I suspect humans are the only animals that know the inevitability of their own deaths. Other animals live in the present. Humans cannot. So they invented hope. Yeah, so I think that's an interesting way of looking at that, of we are maybe the only animals that can forecast in the way that we do, and that's why we fear death, and that's why we quote-unquote invented hope. So that's an interesting way into that theme, I think.
I do think for Kaufman, like, some of these ideas presented that he presents through the film, I definitely think a lot of them probably are not his own, like in the sense of he may not hold to them, but they're presented in a way I feel as like, oh, you know, to provoke thought, critical thought about them, these concepts. And much of Kaufman's film, I think this is maybe a good place to like bring in later in the film, if it's okay to say this, I think we encounter this pig animal that we've been kind of presented before, or it's been referenced before, a pig that has died and was kind of in a way being eaten alive, right, by maggots. I think I have that correct.
Yeah.
Right. Kaufman's engagement with animals is interesting in his films because I find it's similar in some ways to Kafka in his writing, where animals have get the sentience that is also conscious and aware of language or time or perception and feeling that's similar to what we understand as humans having. And I think it's important to maybe think also that while this is being said, like, oh, humans have this different experience, I think maybe Kaufman maybe is open to the thoughts that animals may have a much more similar experience than we give them credit for. And maybe that isn't his position. But for me, as someone who I believe that animals do, I do see in some of Kaufman's work that humans do seem to think of themselves quite differently at times, some of the characters, than animals. But animals are still presented on occasion as with perspective, where they're like compassion is presented, kindness, thought in a way that I think is very important for the film, because much of this film for me has to do with a sort of a bit of vanity and arrogance by the individual who I don't think we've spoken about a lot yet, but Jake, who seems to be at first sight the main character of the film, one of the main characters of the film. And I get a sense that there is a lot of pseudo-intellectualism going on in the film at times, and this sense of wanting validation and wanting to be seen. I think that's a very big theme that's present in the work. So I think that, yeah, human vanity definitely is on display quite a bit in the film. I'm not sure Kaufman's intent with that, but at least that seems to be what I see in the film.
Yeah, I like all of that, and I think that kind of gets to the point that I think it's hard to nail down what Kaufman thinks about what he's showing us, right? I think because it often is showing two different perspectives about something, and I think in this film in particular, perspective is so important. And actually, they towards the beginning, I can't remember exactly what the dialogue is, but and they kind of both say, oh, perspective. And it's, I'm like, oh, that's like a little wink. Like, that's something we need to key into, that this movie is going to deal with a lot. And there is something towards the end, which I think we'll talk about the end maybe a little later, but that I think like maybe this is sort of a thesis, or sort of like this is maybe Kaufman's opinion coming out. But even that, I'm not sure. But yeah, I like that perspective of animals. And when she first goes into the barn, when they arrive at the parents' house, I don't think I really even set this up. I think this is going to be just a spoiler discussion, so listen to this after you've watched it. But if you are listening and you haven't watched it, it's basically a boyfriend and girlfriend going to meet his parents. But around that, it's tons of dialogue and strange goings on. So anyway, they go to the house and they go first into the barn, and she sees the sheep, and her voiceover says, "And I wonder what the experience of a sheep must be like. So boring to just sit in the pen all day." Yeah, so about the pig. So he explains that there was an incident where these pigs, they were discovered that they had maggots all inside of them. And that's gross, right? I think that's meant to strike you as kind of disgusting. But yeah, then at the end, we meet this pig as a cartoon, basically, and see that played out. And he's talking, and he says, "Yeah, you know, it's not so bad once you accept that this is what you are. You know, somebody's got to be a pig with maggots in their stomach. So like, you can kind of learn to love life anyway," which is so odd. But then I think you're right that the equating of like an animal's experience with a human's, and what I think it's kind of saying, like, a pig with maggots inside of it. That's really gross, but that's kind of what we all are. And so that made me think, like, actually recently I was just reading a science thing about how we all have these bacteria in our stomach. So like, they're eating us alive all the time. Like, that's true of every human, that we have things inside of us eating us. And actually that's why like bodies decompose in the graves, is because they're eaten from the inside out. So sorry, that's pretty gross too. But I think it's so, like, what's disgusting to us is very subjective. Like, we've been trained what's gross. And then there's right. also talk about, you know, everything wants to live. Even viruses want to live, you know, maybe right. even maggots want to live, and pigs that are sick want to live. And so, yeah, just equating those experiences, I think, is a really interesting thing that, you know, I probably never have thought about, and wouldn't have if I hadn't watched this movie.
Yeah. And I like that. Jake seems to be a bit cold to the experience of the dead sheep, and mm-hmm. also the pig who died in this, what seems to us a very disgusting or morbid way.
Yeah.
But it seems Lucy is compassionate and caring and considering the lives of these creatures, and trying to be empathetic and compassionate to their plight. And I think this is something we see throughout the film compared to, at times, Lucy sometimes yeah. changes perspective. But
yeah, I was going to say that too. It almost seems like maybe that's an identity swapping thing, because they mm-hmm. in one scene in particular I'm thinking about, they swap. But yeah, go ahead.
I feel at first Jake is, and through much of the film, he is avoiding human contact. He seems to be putting up walls and putting up structures psychologically to distance his mother and his father from himself. He seems ashamed of his parents mm-hmm. and his sort of how they speak, how they confuse words. He also seems to kind of avoid being kissed or having a closeness at times with Lucy, mm-hmm. who's his partner in the film, as far as we can tell. He does seem to be blocking out a lot of compassion and consideration, and not wanting to be almost intruded upon. And his mother in the film says he really wants control. And there's a specific scene where he's trying to stop Lucy from going down to the basement, which I think is an important part of the film, and seems to be blocking it. And there's a reference to Freud in the film in a way. It's, but also I'm noting that to a Jungian idea, and I think maybe Freudian, of the basement representing, or the house structure representing the psyche, and mm-hmm. within the basement are these dark primal experiences, or even these shameful, guilty-like experiences. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be Kaufman is using these kind of maybe archetypes or symbols to convey something about Jake, who is very protective and controlling of different regions of himself, categorizing and compartmentalizing different facets of his life throughout different rooms of the house, which is, I think, very interesting. And it's depicted in a very good way, in my opinion, by Kaufman and those who made the film.
Yeah, that is fascinating. None of that occurred to me, but that totally makes sense. As I was thinking about why is the basement so significant, what she ultimately finds down there is his paintings. And so maybe if he's trying to be this kind of pseudo-intellectual and kind of stand up to her, if he's like insecure about how smart she is, kind of, maybe he's sort of hiding the more artistic feeling side of himself by keeping the paintings and things down there a secret from her, and trying to guard that in his psyche. Yeah, that's very interesting. I think that gets to the point of art, which, so if a lot of this movie is about subjective experience and the way we perceive things one way or the other, I think there's several mentions of art and the way that kind of plays into that. And I want to talk about a few of those. So for one thing, there's it said early on, I think they're talking about the paintings. Yeah, they're at dinner, and she's a painter, and there's a phrase said that you might experience an environment differently than someone else. Someone might think it's beautiful while you think it's cold and scary, but the environment's the same. That's all in your head. Like, so it's just pointing back mm-hmm. to like, this is, that's in you. That's not actually the world. It's the same. And then the dad goes into this, he says that he thinks abstract art is a con job, and it's a scam, and it's has no value. And then he complains that there's no people in her paintings. It's all these landscapes. And he says, I need to see a person in the painting reacting so I know how to feel. Like, if they're, if I see someone there sad, then I know I'm supposed to be sad. And I think that's sort of poking fun at people who treat art that way, because there is sort of a tendency, at least in like popular films and stuff, to kind of be lead the audience in how they're supposed to be feeling about something instead of allowing them to do that themselves. So that was my thought with that, is that Kaufman's kind of poking fun at art that panders to people. And then he kind of literalizes that too with this funny Robert Zemeckis movie thing in the middle of the movie. We get this scene with this janitor character, which we find out is probably Jake in the future. At least that's how I read that. And he is on his lunch break watching this Robert Zemeckis movie, and it's very much, pandering, quote unquote, where it's got the music is swelling, and it's got kind of an over the top, maybe not that realistic speech about being in love, and then it says directed by Robert Zemeckis. So it's kind of a funny, I don't know if he's meaning to directly poke at Robert Zemeckis, but I think that's kind of getting at that same idea that, the way we perceive art, sometimes we're controlled. The way we're perceived things is controlled. There also is a funny scene where they sing this jingle of the kind of a Dairy Queen stand-in. It's like a what is it called? Like Tiny Town or something like that. I can't remember. But they sing that they both know this jingle from the commercial so well, and it's kind of pointing at how much these things affect us and things lead us. And there's also a point made about comparing. So they talk about how everything wants to live, even viruses want to live. And then at one point they compare a film to a virus because when you watch it, you start to become it. It has an effect on you and you start to imitate that. And that's how advertising works, right? Is by leading you to want to purchase ice cream or whatever. So all those I thought were really interesting points. And then I think the biggest representation of this is the woman under the influence scene, which I think is my favorite scene in the movie. It's really interesting. It is the one I'm thinking of where it seems like they almost switch places, where she goes into, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think she's quoting directly a review, I think by Pauline Kael.
Pauline Kael. Yeah.
And that's funny too. So it seems like they are switching because he is the one who had Pauline Kael's book on his shelf in his childhood bedroom. Yes. There's some funny little hints there. Yeah. Were you going to say something there?
I was going to say also with the poem she said that she had been writing early in the film, she recites a poem that she says she has written. And later we see that this is a poem by Eva H.D. From Rotten Perfect Mouth. A book that he has in his home as well. So it seems as if, like kind of what you're saying about films being like a virus, art, media can infiltrate oneself, and it's difficult to know what is one's own and what comes from without. So I see that in Kaufman often, this sense of what is my own, or have I just kind of reappropriated these ideas or this thought, or am I just regurgitating this thought or view or feeling that isn't really my own? How can we distinguish like what is one's own and what isn't, or are there really, you know, strict boundaries between them?
Yeah. And that gets to the whole identity swapping thing too, which this is helping me understand that, because in a lot of his movies, in Being John Malkovich, there's identities moving around or different souls in different bodies and that kind of thing. And then in Synecdoche, New York, there's some of that as well. And so maybe it's kind of the same thing of, you know, what would it be like if time didn't work the way we expected it? What would it be like if identity didn't work the way we expected it to be? And she has a line too about, I don't know where I end and he begins. And that's something you hear about relationships in general. Like that can just be like, oh, I'm getting too sucked into his identity and I don't know my sense of self kind of thing. But then it applies here too. And there's also a line where someone said, I can't remember which character says it, but it says, you're a physicist. So they're apparently both physicists. It seems at different points that maybe they have different jobs at different times. It's kind of confusing. But you're a physicist, so you know that everything is the same. Me, you, landscapes, ideas, they're all made of the same thing. So it's like all matter is made of one thing, which is just, again, like equating people's different experiences. Even though we have our own perceptions, we're kind of all connected too in a way. So,
In Synecdoche, I think there's a line by one of the characters where a character says, everything is everything, which is similar to this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Did you want to go into kind of like the Pauline Kael review?
Yes, yeah,
but not
sorry.
Just the review, but yeah, if you, I sort of wanted to hear your perspective on that when they're kind of swapping perspectives, it seems, or something
yeah,
like that.
I got off on a bunch of tangents, but I did mean to get back
oh,
to that.
No.
Yeah.
That's good.
So they've left and they are driving back home, and I went back and watched the scene again because I liked it so much, but he says you had a lot of wine at dinner, you don't want to make decisions under the influence. And then she does the Gina Rowlands kind of impression, just a smidgen of like the raspberry thing. So if you've never seen A Woman Under the Influence, it's a film from the 70s, I believe, by John Cassavetes, and it's basically about a woman struggling with severe mental health, and Gina Rowlands has this just powerhouse performance where she does a lot of those kind of funny raspberries. She's hitting herself, talking down to herself, and it's pretty widely regarded as a really good movie. And so that comes up, and he says, "Oh, it's a great film." And then she says, "You know, I'm not sure if I agree." And then suddenly, out of nowhere, this cigarette appears, which is so funny. And she's smoking a cigarette, and she starts quoting this negative review of the film that is meant to be very kind of. I read it as like kind of poking fun at critics, and I think that's Kaufman is interested in the relationship between artists and critics, and she has this very kind of calculated reason why all this movie's not that good, and why there's problems with it. And then he kind of moves into this place of, well, you know, I just felt like I identified with her, and he has kind of an emotional reaction to the movie. And I feel like Kaufman is pointing out there, maybe this is just my reading into it, what I want to see in it, but like that's maybe a more valid way to talk about art, is like, how did it make you feel? And that kind of gets to the whole reason I want to do this podcast as the snob-free film community, because critics love to say, here's why it's bad. And I would rather say, here's what I experienced with it. So that really connected with me. And he kind of keeps talking in circles and kind of gets into an existential crisis where he's like, he talks about quote unquote, the lie of it all. And she says, what lie are you talking about? That it's going to get better, that it's never too late, that God has a plan for you, and that age is just a number, and all these kind of platitudes. And she uses the word platitudes that we use to make ourselves feel better, again, about maybe the invention of hope that, we as humans are afraid of the future, and so we make these things up. So anyway, all of that is it, and all there's like layers to it, and it's just kind of a nice little stew of all these kind of ideas in this one little scene that I really, really liked.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that scene as well. And it feels as though for me, when Lucy's character, after she says she quotes this review, and Jake responds in a more sincere way and then goes into these sorts of what she considers platitudes. He does also say something, I think, a little bit later about it would be important. I'm not sure if it's right before or right after, that it's nice to have someone to blame. And there is this emphasis on potentially like the female or the mother to be blamed. And she says, that's just patriarchal BS or Freudian BS. Like, we, you know, this is ridiculous because a mother is supposed to be coddling her child too much, her boy. He could have these mental illnesses or disorders later on, and how this is very dangerous thinking and we shouldn't go in this direction. But the character seems to be very sad, Jake, but he seems to be like, yeah, but, it, you know, it'd be nice to have someone to blame for. Yeah. And it just that struck me as very almost scary and horrific, and also a criticism of. For me, it seems Kaufman was criticizing this sense of pointing to someone else to blame about something like that, where she says, Lucy, this time to take responsibility. And I do think both can be true in the sense of, obviously, you know, abuse to children is completely traumatic and affects life, the rest of their lives. But also for particularly men who, as far as Jake is concerned, seems to be, from what we can tell, has had like an okay experience in life. And obviously, we don't know the ins and outs of everything, but he probably needs to take responsibility for some of his like disassociation and detachment from people, his compartmentalizing of people and his experiences. And I think that is, she brings up an important point at this point, saying, hey, like the responsibility is needed. And some of these ideas you're talking about are very problematic and very patriarchal. And then later he talks about Baby, It's Cold Outside. He acts as if he doesn't know that that's like a song that tinged with like coercion and rape connotations. Mm-hmm. But earlier in the film, he's making claims like, oh, we shouldn't say certain things, and sort of promoting like a feminist perspective. But he falls back into like reverting to something else later on, which is really interesting to me.
Yeah, I really like that too. And actually, I was going to segue into that, because in that scene, she talks about that. And we said, we can't blame mothers for everything. Yeah, it's a BS from Freud. And she says, yeah, mothers have been blamed for XYZ, you know, autism or depression, anxiety, or homosexuality. And she uses that word, and he says, well, that would imply that homosexuality is a negative thing to lump it in with all those. And she says, well, no, I'm just, that was how it was seen at that time, basically, is kind of what she says. And that kind of idea comes in a few times. Like you mentioned at the beginning, she quotes Betty Davis, actually, who we've talked about in this podcast quite a bit in previous episodes, getting old ain't for sissies. And so first of all, that's a great quote about just aging and ageism, which I want to talk about in a minute. But that he says, you know, I wouldn't want that word sissies to be normalized. That's, you know, an offensive term for X, Y, and Z reason. And then similar thing with Baby It's Cold Outside. It's like another way that perception of things has shifted with time and culture. And back then there was this idea of it. And now we have a better understanding or different understanding, and just again pointing at the fact that like time changes, the changes is the way we experience time. So like that's how we can know things are changing. How we can know that time is moving is that things have changed over time. Anyway, but that's interesting. And then that also, there's a moment where the father says something very similar to the word sissy. He says, they're talking about a movie with Billy Crystal. I can't remember, but he says Billy Crystal is a Nancy. And it's a moment where they're awkward and they don't know what to say, which, you know, we experience that with the older generation, you know, pretty frequently. They say things that we have a different understanding of, and she doesn't confront him in that moment. And I think that's like, it's a difficult thing to do. But I think, again, it's just pointing at those kind of generational differences, anyway, that's really interesting. And along with that, I want to say, I think that David Thewlis is probably the most laughs I got out of this movie was from him. I think his performance is really strong and really funny, as well as it's so odd. But
yeah, I thought the performances overall were excellent by all the, I think, the four main characters that we see get the most screen time. I thought it was really incredible. And dark humor is present, and black humor throughout the film. And I think it helps bring a bit of levity to, I think, a very serious film in certain ways. Yeah. I think Kaufman brings levity and laughter and just fun throughout all of his films. But this one does have a darker tone. And I sort of wanted to talk about the ice cream stop they make. You referenced it earlier.
Yeah.
I think that was something that is a pivotal, maybe not pivotal, but it stood out to me also visually. The ice cream shop with its neon and fluorescent lights surrounded by this like shroud of darkness, and they have their old like Oldsmobile car, and I don't know what state they're in. I wasn't sure, but it seems to be something like in, you know, central, like, I don't know, North Dakota, South Dakota or something.
I mean, it's something just where the play Oklahoma would be really common, right? So that's something that comes in. So I thought, yeah, probably Midwest something. But yeah, go ahead. I was confused by the ice cream stuff. So yeah, jump into that.
Okay, yeah, well, I thought it was very interesting because he seems not to want to talk to people there, and he seems to be unsure of who is there. And he says something like, oh, I don't like some of the girls who work here. Mm-hmm. And we see two girls who come out who don't really pay attention to Lucy when she's wanting to order. They seem to be giggling, laughing, just like looking at Jake. Mm-hmm. And she's kind of confused by that. Finally, someone else comes in who has much less makeup on and who has rashes or like sores on her arms and on her body, it seems. And she says, hey, you're not like those other girls who she's working with, that you seem, you know, I don't know. It's like something like she seems more genuine and connected and not this pretty. But then she's like, oh, I'm sorry, not meaning to call you not pretty. But there's a sense of coldness with my colleagues here, and you don't have that really, but maybe these pretty people hurt as well. Mm-hmm. It's very strange. And I think I watched this with Vanessa, and she was telling me that she saw like a rash on Jake's hand.
Yeah.
I guess he reached out to pay or get the dessert. And it seemed to be that that was very similar to what was happening with one of the employees. So there seemed to be some sort of connection or understanding, mm-hmm. or acknowledgement there. And then when they were getting ready to leave, Lucy seems to say, to thank the worker, and the worker says something like, I'm kind of worried, you know, you can stay here if you want. Mm-hmm. There's this ominous feeling like, oh, this could become very bad. This seems dangerous. What is Jake going to do? There's this really ominous, strange feeling around it, as if she's really concerned for Lucy and what she could be going into next. It was kind of an outlier to me, this kind of place in the middle of nowhere, mm-hmm. This ice cream shop. It was very surreal and strange to me, but it sort of, in some ways, I think, foreshadowed, of course, what was to come, because later we do see a dumpster near the high school with mm-hmm. lots full, of these desserts. Yeah. Just full of these frozen dessert drinks. I thought it was a very beautiful look, like just visually, and then also very striking, the two kind of giggling girls and girl workers, and then the other who is more somber, who is just really exhausted in her work. She seems to be doing the most work, and she seems to be in pain in some way, but she's also kind enough to let Lucy know, hey, something problematic could be happening. It struck me as very, I guess, Kafka-esque. The scene was like that for me. But I enjoyed it.
Yeah, so I was able to watch most of the movie again a second time to kind of prepare for this. And there's a moment early on when we first are seeing the janitor character, and we see that the kind worker there, she's there at high school as a student. And I think that the two blonde girls are as well. And you kind of get a sense that like there's some bullying going on there. And so I'm wondering if this is like a time anomaly. Like they're either from the future or the past or something. They seem kind of old-timey in a way, like retro in a way. Mm-hmm. The ice cream shop in general feels that way, kind of a 50s theme. So it's like, mm-hmm. I'm not sure where in time we're supposed to be, but yeah, it almost seemed like they had bullied Jake maybe in high school or something. And the janitor character, which again, I think is Jake in the future. We see them kind of looking at him and kind of making fun of him. And then the kind girl kind of making a kind face in his direction. So it is mysterious. I think too, that there's something, with the book that this is based on. So this is based on a novel, which I have not read. I did a little research. I read the Wikipedia page about it. I think there's also an article on IndieWire about the differences between the novel and the movie, which I have not read yet, but I'll link to that. But I think in the novel, there's an actual Dairy Queen. Like they just use the brand of Dairy Queen. So this is a stand-in for that. So I think this probably is a scene from the book. Before I talk about the ending of the book, let's wait till we kind of get to the end of the movie, because it kind of plays in. But so it does affect this. One other thing about this scene, I didn't notice the rash on Jake, like you mentioned, until the second time I watched that, and I rewound it to see like, oh, he has the same thing. And so I don't know what that's about, but there is some sort of a commonality there. And just now when you were talking about that, I thought like maybe it's supposed to sort of symbolize like leprosy, because it kind of looks like leprosy. I don't know that much about leprosy, but that would be like an othering sort of a feeling, maybe, right? Like the popular, the pretty, yes, people are othering them because they're the uncool lepers of high school or something.
Yeah. And wasn't it in the car when they were driving to maybe the either before or after going to that ice cream shop, he says something like he remembers seeing his high school classmates around, and yeah, they still carry the weight like a millstone of, mm-hmm, their kind of ostracism or their, you know, this kind of otherness that was placed on them. And it marks them for a long period of their life. Mm-hmm. And I think I've read something about Kaufman. I believe that I've read it. I don't know how true this is, mm-hmm, but it was said that Kaufman experienced being being laughed at. I think it was in high school or maybe early college by a friend of his that laughed at a joke, but just really actually didn't find it funny. And it seemed to really affect him, this sense that, oh, I was really trying to or connect or be funny or have this experience with the friend, and the friend faked it for a moment and then kind of just moved on and wasn't really connected to the experience. But I thought that was interesting. But yeah, the focus on this otherness that's marked by maybe the rash or the leprosy, I think you're right. That would make a lot of sense, that they're kind of shunned for whatever reason and marginalized, and that kind of continues and goes on with them over time.
Yeah, it's really, so he does, you're right, in the car. I think it's just before that he suddenly is speaking as if he's his future self, and he talks about people in the high school that he's seen. And then there's watching it a second time, I realized there's a brief moment in the beginning when they're driving where he begins to speak as if he's from the future, like he's his future self, kind of jumping back. And also there's a moment where the father character is speaking about his wife as if she's dead, even though she's right there with him. And so that's another just time anomaly thing, I think. But he says, you know, that's one of the things I loved about her. And we're like, is he talking about her as if she's deceased? So yeah, that's another interesting time thing there. Okay, yeah, so with the ageism discussion, so yeah, we do see the characters kind of jumping back and forth at different ages. We see Jake taking care of his mother when she's old and unable to take care of herself, and she praises him for that. And then there's a discussion when they're almost to the high school where he says something positive about youth or youthfulness, and she kind of calls him on that and says, you know, the old people have value as well. Praising someone for their age is like admiring a point in a stream. It's like it makes no sense. It's pointless. And he kind of goes to bat and says, well, the people who are young make scientific discoveries more and artistic creations more and that kind of thing. And our bodies start to fall apart as we get old. And we've kind of seen that happen with Toni Collette's character. And that kind of gets back to that Wordsworth poem too, where when we're born, we still have the glow of something divine, and that kind of fades with age. And so all that to say, like, I think that's an interesting thing that comes up again and again in the movie too, is how we treat the elderly, basically, and his memories going, and the father character. So there's some interesting things there too. But yeah, I think that was an interesting aspect to it.
Yeah. It seems like Jake, while he's at home, and we see these different periods in the life of his mother as she's aging, as she's sort of on her deathbed, it seems he's by her side, he's caring for her. Mm-hmm. But in a way, it almost, for me, it feels like there's this sense that he wants to connect, but he's having a lot of a great difficulty in connecting with his family and with Lucy at times. Mm-hmm. For whatever reasons, that I think it's difficult to know, but it may have to connect to bullying or something in high school or before. But it does seem like I get a sense that he's continuing to put up walls. He's trying to be caring and considerate, but my mind goes back to his mother saying, you know, he wants control. He wants to be seen. He wants this validation. And I do think that the aging of the characters is important, because there's this, it, related to Jake as the janitor, perhaps, and I agree with you in that. I think that's the case later in life. There's this idealization of youth, mm-hmm. And this sort of rejection of old age as valuable.
Yeah,
and I think Kaufman disagrees with that, or he wants to disagree with that. It seems in his film.
He at least makes us want to question that. Because, yeah, too, in Synecdoche, New York, there's a lot of aging. And in that movie, I think we almost kind of just get a picture of a whole life. I think that's kind of just a reflection on a lifespan kind of thing. Because we have Philip Seymour Hoffman there, very old at the end of the movie. But then at various times, old and young. And something odd with his daughter's age as well in that. But the speaking of Philip Seymour Hoffman, I think there's sort of a funny similarity that with the janitor character that maybe kind of gets at this ageism idea as well. is that, yeah, we tend to be kind of grossed out by pigs, right? Like, we have the cartoon pig there, and we kind of talked about how, like, that's gross in a sense, but I think maybe he's challenging us to say, like, you know, that's part of nature kind of thing. I think that there's can be a disgust with bodies, especially older bodies, and maybe that's kind of pushing that that idea when we see him walking, his we see his whole body as he's an older man at the end of the movie. And just even his physicality kind of reminds me of Philip Seymour Hoffman, especially as he's old in Synecdoche, New York. He's just kind of an older kind of an aged body. And I think that is something that's prevalent. I think about some recent horror movies I've seen, they use naked older bodies as a thing to scare you. And I that's something that's an issue I kind of have with some of those things that I think that maybe he's kind of in a sly way, maybe pushing against that. So anyway,
yes.
Let's talk about the ending, because I think we're kind of getting this. So they get to the high school, and there's some weirdness in the car, basically. There's a lot of weirdness in this whole movie. But they get there, and he basically goes in. At one point, they're kissing in the car, and then there's like a flash of an eye looking through a peephole kind of thing. And he says, "Somebody was watching us. What a pervert," or something like that. And he also says something like, "It's a look I know well." And she says, why did you say that? But then he gets out to go beat up whoever was watching them. And I was like, well, that was an odd little thing. It's a very abrupt little cut in the middle of what's happening. And I think maybe if that is the janitor, it's him in the future. It's another just time anomaly. Like, he was peering back through time, or he was like looking nostalgically, remembering that way back in the day. So it's almost like they were realizing someone was peering back through time with them or something. But that's the thing that incites them both eventually to get into the high school. And she talks to the janitor character. She sees him there. And at this point, it starts to call into question some things. And this is where reading the synopsis of the book really kind of brought some things to light for me. So I'm going to kind of explain that. So if you don't want the book to be spoiled, if you wanted to go read that, then maybe tune out. But basically, we've learned earlier in the film that the way they met, they were at a trivia night at a bar, and she kind of noticed him. This is how she tells it to his mother anyway. She kind of noticed him and then talked to him, and then he asked for her number, essentially. It's kind of, but there's a few different inconsistencies in her story that the father character actually calls out, and there's an awkward kind of tension there. But then later, when he's gone into the high school and she's kind of like, am I going to die out here? And she's kind of going crazy a little bit in the car, and kind of freaking out and talking to herself. And she says something about, why did I even say yes to that? I didn't want to. When he asked for my number, I just felt pressure to. And so that's we get a different side of that story. And then when she goes in, she talks to the janitor and says, kind of talks about that night at trivia night, and then basically reveals or expresses at that time that it never happened, that they never actually met. And so that throws the whole movie into sort of an interesting light. And this is where the book plot kind of plays in. So in the book, there's a similar plot where they're, you know, going to meet the parents and then go into this high school. But it's kind of revealed that there's a janitor at the high school, and some characters are talking. This is all according to the Wikipedia page for this book, so I haven't actually read it. But some characters are talking about a horrific thing that happened at the high school, and it's slowly revealed over the book what that is. And then we find out that the janitor character has died. It seems like maybe died by suicide. At the high school. So maybe that's what we're seeing at the very end, when he's kind of trudging into the high school without any clothes on. Maybe that's the end of his life. It wasn't exactly clear to me, but that's maybe the commonality there. But also in the book, he writes in notebooks a lot, and in his notebooks he's written about, I think the book also takes place from her point of view, the same character, Lucy, up until a certain point, where we realize that he's imagined it, that he did see this girl at trivia night at a bar, wanted to talk to her, but didn't. And then in his notebooks has imagined this entire story from her perspective. And so that, I think that is sort of being revealed there when she is talking to the janitor that maybe their relationship doesn't actually exist. This is all in his head. And so he's imagining himself as a physicist to be up to her level when actually, and I think in the book, he dropped out of college and became the high school janitor at the high school that he attended. And so it's a very different life. And so he's sort of dreaming that he's, you know, her quote unquote equal standing with her in some of those ways. So that kind of throws a new light into the movie for me. And that's sort of where the movie goes. And then there's an Oklahoma dance sequence that's kind of interesting. And then there's the final scene at the theater. So yeah. What was that, your kind of understanding of how that went?
Yes. Once she goes up the stairs to the high school, and then we talked about before seeing like the dumpster full of these, like these dessert drinks, and she goes in and she meets the janitor, and then it seems to be shown that, for me, I got the sense that he was the originator of this story in some way, and that in some way he's constructed these characters and these events. Not that that's super clear, or that that's really.
Yeah. I did not get that from the movie until I read that. But yeah, go on.
Okay. I got a sense that this is something constructed, but also that wasn't really the emphasis for me. And I wasn't thinking this explains the whole film. It's not like a key to unlock the whole film. Yeah. But it did seem to be, something where when we see the dance between she and Jake are standing in front of each other, and then duplicates of them come out, these copies, but they are in some ways a bit different, a bit more, I guess, like dancers or agile, and sort of like maybe an idealized version of what Jake thinks of himself or this woman. They are dancing, and then it begins to snow, I think, in the gymnasium. But there, at first, a janitor-like figure comes to attack Lucy, or is it Lucy's duplicate? I think it's Lucy's duplicate, right?
I think so.
And then they go into the gymnasium, it begins to snow, and there's this battle, this strange dancing battle between the duplicate of Jake and the janitor. And it feels like at this time for me that the janitor has now, the reality of the janitor has intruded upon the fantasy or the idealized version of his life as Jake, and is now destroying that conception because Lucy has now met the janitor, realizing in some way, potentially kind of uncovering the truth.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And this relates to the basement, because in the basement, in the laundry, are the clothing, the janitor clothes that is worn by the janitor. Mm-hmm. And I think this is kind of her recognition, realization, almost like a character come to life in some way, this consciousness of the character that, oh, hey, I this is what's going on. I'm part of this story. And that's why I feel like there are intrusions at times. Maybe this is just my interpretation. Mm-hmm. There are intrusions into her thoughts by Jake. Jake seems to be like aware of her internal dialogue at times. And this is really interesting and sort of, before we get to the very end, the ending scene, which I if you want to, I'd be open to talking about, because I found it really absurd and strange. Yeah. But funny as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And sort of, it's a lot. I felt like her experience was moving, but also very fraught with like tragedy and like the film is. I'm thinking of ending things like, or this kind of phrase that is going on for her. And I don't know if she means like at first suicide, if she means I want to break up with Jake, but it feels in some way that her experience in reality is intruded upon by the demands that Jake is making, that the demands of he trying to have her in his life in some way and control certain aspects of her. And then as we realize, in my opinion, and I think you kind of agree, that the janitor is sort of crafting this story and is kind of creating this in some way to some degree, it feels as if she is definitely in this world of of another person. And she is receiving reality in some way from another person while also trying to maintain her autonomy or like create her autonomy. And I feel like for me, this speaks to kind of society in which we live. Not like this is like what Kaufman's saying, but this is kind of what I get from it, that there is this patriarchal structure and women are expected to kind of be there to approve of, validate, and see men, and their kind of agency is taken away. There's coercion talked about much in the film. There's this sense that her ideas are being kind of co-opted by him at times, and she doesn't even know her name at times. He calls her different names. She receives these voice messages throughout the film, which seems to be an older man, possibly the janitor, who's saying things are very difficult and kind of just laying out these concerns that are existential concerns and putting a responsibility on her to like navigate it. And throughout the film, I get a sense that she has this pressure that shouldn't be hers, and it's coming from the outside, and it's very difficult for her to navigate. And I feel like it's kind of a criticism in some way against not being responsible for oneself and putting one's own burdens on somebody else and like trying to control or influence other people and manipulate them to get what you want. That's part of the experience. I think there's a lot more going on, but for me, that's something I kind of felt towards the end of the film when we meet the janitor and get a sense that maybe, you know, this is older Jake and seeing his life or creating the story of his life, who he wanted to be, like you said, to be on par with a woman in which he sees as like beautiful, intelligent, blah, 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 like in this patriarchal way. So that's sort of a feeling I got about it.
Yeah, like it's sort of like breaking down the dream girl myth or something like that. But yeah, she even verbalizes that at one point. Like she, I think it's when she's talking to herself in the car, says, you know, why did I say yes to him? I wished that my boyfriend would have come. And how sad is it that I have to have another man there to feel safe? And kind of talks about that very real problem in society. But yeah, I did not intuit all the things about the janitor having crafted the story, but that makes perfect sense because then we see the dance and all that you're talking about. And in the dance sequence, there's like a marriage. So it's like he's imagining himself having met her and married her. And then I think the janitor ends up killing him, like killing the young Jake character. So it's like he almost gets to die a hero's death or something. So it's, I don't know if maybe that's just me reading into it, but that he's the hero of his own story in a sense. But yeah, I think it's a really interesting scene. But yeah, let's talk about the ending scene because I really liked it. It is very odd. It actually, there's a scene kind of similar in Anomalisa at the end, where in that film, David Thewlis is the lead and he has a speech. He's an author or something, but he has a speech to a crowd that ends up being significant. And so there's kind of a connection there. And then also in Synecdoche, New York, I believe there's some scenes, it's been a while since I watched that, but there's some scenes where he's speaking to a crowd from a podium. And that's kind of like a visual motif almost at this point for Kaufman. But the scene itself, so he's accepting like a Nobel Peace Prize, it seems like, or something. And he's, he and everyone else has stage makeup to age them. They look very old. And so then it's everyone, it seems to me that it's everyone in his life that affected him, is there for this moment. And he's kind of looking back at like a retrospective of his life. And it's not the janitor, it's young Jake in old makeup, which is interesting. And then everyone in the audience is in old makeup. And so for me, this kind of got to the point of identity that, you know, our identity is, I guess it's a nature versus nurture question, but we are, we become like the movies that we watch and we are affected by the ads that we see. And our identity may be essentially just a combination of all the people that affected us, you know, in a way. So then we have like the high school bullies and how they shaped his experience. And then the kind girl, how they shaped his experience, how she shaped his experience, his mother and father. And then, he says in his speech, it seems like he's kind of saying it to Lucy's character that I've done this all for you or something. So like this idea of, she had just a profound impact on him. If, you know, as we're discussing, maybe they never even met and this isn't all invented, or right. they just experienced each other across the room in a bar or something. So he gives this speech, and this is the point too where I think it's hard to always intuit what is Kaufman's opinion about this situation in some of these scenes. Mm-hmm. But in this one, he has at the end of his speech, this line that I think maybe can kind of sum it up a little bit. He said, "It is only in the mysterious equations of love that any logical reasons can be found." And so I think that's sort of getting at, you know, maybe even watching this movie, there's a lot of philosophical things going on. And if you feel confused by that or by you know, overly academic things like a movie review of a well-renowned movie or just all those things can be overwhelming. But kind of getting back to the point of like the experience of love is the most important thing. That's kind of how I read it. I don't know if you agree with that, but.
Yeah, I did like the line that you quoted about the mysterious. I don't remember the exact quote, but like that love in this mysterious equation of love, we have, you know, reasons, logical reasons can like make sense or find meaning, and that is what is important. There's a line of "You are all my reasons." I guess he's speaking to the whole crowd, and each person plays a role in developing and making a person who they are in some way, and I think that's present in many of Kaufman's films. In Synecdoche in New York, each person has a role they're supposed to perform. Mm-hmm. But it also feels like, for me, the conclusion of this creative act that feels a bit egotistical or narcissistic to some degree, kind of like Philip Seymour Hoffman's character, Caden Cotard, in Synecdoche, New York, replicating real life in a warehouse and replicating New York City within a warehouse. And each real person is played by an actor performing that role on a day-to-day basis. There's this sense that through the creative life, real life can be had, and in the fictional life, it's more real than the real. And in some way, I feel as though personally, and I guess I have hopes that Kaufman would feel that that isn't true completely. Mm-hmm. The creative life does allow liberties and new understandings, and allows for wonderful experiences and having new perspectives. But it also can't replace a lived life in a way. It can't replace an actual life of like responsibility, duty, dignity, compassion, connection. And this sense of interiority, I think, is important with Kaufman. Yeah. This sense of the inside the mind, life lived internally, which has value, which has a place. But it seems like many of his characters struggle with interiority over interiority, where the outside world is very difficult to ascertain, to deal with, to manage, and that the internal life seems to be most prominent. But I think Kaufman, in some way, from interviews I've watched of him and sort of just watching his works more and more, it does seem like through compassion, through love, through connection, through empathy, we can go beyond this interiority that can be a negative interiority at times, while taking stock in it, like, hey, this is like the richness of life can be found in like creating works of art, having this interior life. But also there are certain limits with it, and we need to maybe reach beyond ourselves if possible, which I think is true, to reach others. And I think that's part of maybe the difficulty Kaufman is navigating in many of his films.
That is a great reading of that, and that I think that makes a lot of sense. That connection to Synecdoche makes perfect sense as well. The scene I thought of actually was a different movie that you discussed with me most recently on the podcast. This scene kind of reminds me of the end of Tree of Life, even though it's a really different. But we have him seemingly surrounded by all the people that affected him in his life, maybe looking at the end of his life, possibly. When at the end of Tree of Life, they're out on this kind of beachfront area, and there's all these people from his past there with him. So I thought that was kind of an interesting way. So, yeah, thinking about the interiority of it is adding a new wrinkle to that for me. But that they talk about interiority specifically early on when they're at the dinner scene. And talking about her paintings, and like they're external because they're landscapes, but she says something about their internal, and there's sort of a joke made about that the dad's like, wait, I thought you said they were external. But she's talking about how that's her internal mind kind of put out on paper. And so maybe that's, And maybe that's what all art is in a way, or maybe that's what these movies are for Kaufman. I don't know. Is his internal experiences trying to get some of those ideas out where we can kind of see them too. But yeah, and then maybe there's danger in that, like you're saying. But and then it ends with a song, which is from Oklahoma. I looked it up. I've actually never seen Oklahoma, but I think the song is called "In a Lonely Room." And so like the story of the song is this guy is lonely, and then a moonbeam comes in and kind of lifts his spirits and makes him either dream or daydream about him being happy. He kind of opens him up to happiness, and he imagines being in love, and he imagines beating his enemies and that sort of thing. And then it goes away and he's lonely again at the end of it. But that seems to then spur him on to like, I'm going to go find a wife. So it's an interesting thing, but for me, that was maybe saying, like the world is a cold and lonely place. And I think that's maybe the point of all the snow as well, which another thing about like perceiving something in different ways. At first, the snow is, oh, she's excited about it. She's like eating a snowflake in the opening of the film. But then at the end, it's very oppressive and treacherous. They use the word treacherous. But so if the world's a cold and lonely place, and then we have that in the snow and in this song from Oklahoma, your experience, if your experience, something can come along and make your experience positive, whether in this song it's the moon, or I think about that's like maybe joy or happiness entering your life, kind of holding on to that when you can. And that actually, that's in line with the ending of Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. There's a quote when they're in that beach scene, and she says, you know, this is about to be all done, this is about to be over, what do we do? And his response is, enjoy it. And so I think maybe this song is getting at the same idea, and that's why he's putting it in the film here, is that life is hard, hold on to the, enjoy the little things, enjoy the things that the joy and the happiness that comes when it comes, because it's not going to necessarily last. Like in this song, it's just a temporary moment. But that's my reading of that finale.
Yeah, I think that's really important, holding on to these moments and connections with between people, and like love, I think is very important for Kaufman. And it provides a respite for the coldness of the world in some way. But I like what you said about the snow. It does seem like at first it's like this joy, this fun time, and then it becomes something very dangerous and threatening in some way in their lives. But yeah, it was, I think it was a really interesting ending and a surreal ending, and it had power to it and it moved me. And then it was also sort of silly and funny. So it was really enjoyable.
Yeah. Like Toni Collette's really hamming it up in that scene. And yeah, it's so bizarre with the way the makeup looks and everything. But yeah, it's an interesting ending. And I was going to say really too quickly that the snow also is a connection, I think, with Eternal Sunshine. There's a lot of snow in that film, and I think it's maybe kind of the same idea. Like the world is cold, so connect and have a warm connection with someone else when you can. Enjoy it when you can. Well, cool. I think that can wrap up our episode. Do you have any other thoughts about the film?
I think that's all. It's something I want to revisit in the future. Mm-hmm. I think with Kaufman films, it's important to do that. I think there are lots of... I think from what you said, your second viewing really helped in working through some things. And for me, I think it would do the same. So I look forward to that.
Yes, absolutely recommend it. For me at this point, I mean, I haven't seen that many new films this year because of COVID, but it's the movie of the year for me this far. I really, really had a strong experience with it. So I recommend it. But all right. Well, thank you again so much for being here, Andrew, and for recording this bonus episode. I as soon as I watched it, I was like, I got to get Andrew on the podcast to talk about this. So thank you.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Andrew. I had a lot of fun watching it, and it was great to talk about it with you. Thank you.
You're so welcome. And if you enjoyed this episode, thanks for listening to it. We are doing new episodes every other week. Right now, we are talking about contemporary Asian filmmakers. We just did Thailand with... We are Sathakul, and then we are about to move into Bong Joon-ho, director of Parasite, with a couple of his films, and then looking at Kurieda as well, coming up with a couple of films. So stay tuned for those. Look in the back catalog. We've done a lot of different movies. If you want to keep up with Arthouse Garage on social media, you can go to @ArthouseGarage on Facebook, Instagram, Letterboxd, Twitter, just about everywhere. We are at Art House Garage, and we're also on YouTube, and there's a blog at arthousegarage.com. Yeah, I think that'll wrap it up. Thanks so much for listening, and until next time, keep it snob-free.